How about now? There we go. By a show of hands, how many people here are part of a family unit of some kind, or have ever been part of a family unit of some kind? Some of you aren't raising your hand. It's concerning. But everybody that did raise their hand, I think, might find something useful or beneficial from what we're going to go over today as we continue in the Gospel of Matthew. Some of us have been blessed with an ideal family, and that's wonderful. Hopefully, we'll this morning be able to expand that model into a truer, deeper understanding of family. And some of us have a real hang-up with the concept of family because we've been let down by an abusive parent or maybe a sibling too consumed with themselves to care about us. Hopefully, this morning, if that's you, we'll be able to reorient our conception of family into a healthier, God-intended design. I'm Cole, by the way. Christy let you know. But I serve as the youth pastor here, and I also, for the next 30 minutes or so, serve as your substitute teacher. And if you have a Bible with you, you'll want to turn to Matthew 12. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. Does anyone here have a friend or family member who's really, really nice as anyone you could think of, yet still has a streak of rage that'll pop up in times of injustice or ineptitude? Yeah. She came in late, so I haven't had a chance to tell her I was going to talk about her. But for me, that's my mom. I just saw her a minute ago sitting there. And I'm in a room with a bunch of really nice folks. You're all so great. So understand that I mean no disrespect when I say that none of you are as kind as my mom. She's the best. But let me also say that I've seen what happens when someone crosses my mom's morals or won't give her message the consideration that it's due. And I can attest that my red hair is no accident, that I have quite an Irish temper in my gene pool. And my siblings and I, we still speak in unmistakable facial expressions when we see her starting to tip towards the edge. And I think this is what we've been seeing from Jesus in this chapter. If we can recall that the chapter started with the Pharisees trying to rebuke Jesus when they saw his disciples going through the grain fields and eating on the Sabbath. That bit ended with Jesus instead rebuking the Pharisees for misappropriating the law, placing sacrifice in the void of mercy. Then he went on to heal a man with a withered hand, and they accuse him of the same Sabbath violations, to which he again calls them out, reverses it back onto the Pharisees. Then he healed many, including a man who was previously blind and mute. Hearing of the miracle, the Pharisees accused Jesus of working for Satan, sparking Jesus to once again invert their problematic logic and embarrassing them with their own words. And then we left off with a brief teaching where Jesus says that a tree is known by its fruit, which is itself a not-so-veiled attack on the Pharisees, at one point dropping any veil that may be there by simply calling them brood of vipers. Right? So basically, this whole chapter is a montage of Jesus recreating different means of showing the pious religious elite his favorite finger. And let's be honest, that's probably adrenaline-fueled fun for the eyewitnesses, for Matt, you know, who's writing this, and the disciples around there. But it's a bit difficult for us because we have a tendency to see Jesus as the meek, emotionless being who only says nice things to everyone. So as we finish this chapter off today, let's allow ourselves to smirk and to cheer and to pump our fists a bit as we surround Jesus and witness his brashness. This is kind of like a first century battle rap is how I envision this. You know, we're watching this on WorldStar and his followers are, you know, oh, he got you, son. Jesus just dropped the bar of the year. And I'm serious, though. That's actually, I think, a far better proxy for what's happening in these verses than the distilled way in which we typically imagine them in 21st century distilled America. And I think we need to drop our pretensions of who Jesus is and take these accounts for what they are. The Pharisees are the playground bullies, and Jesus is standing up to them. And he's standing up to them in, you know, the dopest way possible. And it's going to fill all the other kids with relief and unbridled joy that somebody is finally taking a stand. And that's us. We're those other kids on the playground. So as we look at the chapter's final three accounts, we'll keep in mind all of that and really listen to his concluding thoughts on this rap battle, because it'll all finish up here. You see, we're going to verse 50. That's the end of the chapter, which will give us a sense of the scope and shape of the playground's social structuring. As we explore this morning, we're going to find a deeper ontological understanding of what membership in God's family really is. And what we'll find is that membership in God's family is determined not by geography or religious standards or biology, but by doing God's will. Membership in God's family is determined not by geography or religious standards or biology, but by doing God's will. So let's get started with verse 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, "Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you." But he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Jesus mocks the Pharisees once again, this time with a couplet which first puts the Gentiles of Nineveh from the account of Jonah on a pedestal above the Pharisees. And then second, puts the Gentile queen of the south, queen of Sheba, from 1 Kings 10, on a similar raised platform, also looking down on the lowly Pharisees. Jesus has again invented a way to embarrass their self-righteousness. The Pharisees scoff at his insinuation that he is the Messiah, daring him to produce a sign. A sign, of course, will do nothing. These are men who will not lay down their pride for the Messiah. For them, the Messiah is nothing more than a concept which fuels their power over others. For Jesus to insist that there is a greater reality of that title, that it can be found in the very being on the other end of their conversation, seems some combination of silly and heresy. So Jesus, the mad MC he is, comes back with typical rap battle syntax. He calls them out, you know, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign. And then, knowing he loses whether he produces a sign or ignores their empty self-pandering, he creates a third way. He speaks cryptically about a single sign that is yet to come. As Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And then he transitions that into a final verse about Jonah's audience, the Ninevites, and this queen of the south who will rise against the Pharisees and condemn them. For the softness of heart those Assyrians and that queen displayed has allowed them to see the Christ that now stands before the blind, heart-hardened Pharisees. Jesus isn't providing the sign they want. He's prophesying a sign to come and a dark end to the Pharisees' reign. I mean, this is the same thing that Tupac did, the same thing Nas did. Jesus isn't just going after a dude for fun. He isn't just spitting rhymes to please his ego. He's making pointed observations and promises about people in power, dismantling their wordplay with precise and true words against all that they think gives them power. It hasn't been too long since we studied Jonah. Anybody mind telling me a thing or two about these Ninevites that we know? Literally, my note says, they were bad dudes. We have a winner over there. Anybody have anything else? He's right. They were pretty gnarly. They repented. They were not Jewish, I think is a very interesting note. Jonah, remember when Rob was teaching on that, and Bradley, maybe that's why he knows they were bad dudes. When they were teaching on that, they would reinforce a few times that Jonah is the only prophet that was called to speak to a Gentile nation. It's very, very interesting that Jesus uses them as an example here. And that Jesus uses these Gentile Ninevites and this Gentile queen reinforces the idea that his family includes and welcomes all comers, regardless of location, proximity, or national lines on a map. Everyone is invited into Jesus' kingdom. The Pharisees saw their Jewishness as an entitlement, but Jesus only cared that they were entitled. The temple isn't in Jerusalem. Jesus isn't in Galilee. God isn't in a book. The temple is the homeless shelter downtown. Jesus is the single mother living in the projects in New York, ashamed because she can't afford to feed her children this month. God is the lonely man in a Syrian prison, in dire need of a visitor who can offer a word of encouragement or a message of hope. Because, you see, membership in God's family has nothing to do with geographic boundaries. While cartographers draw lines to mark political borders, the kingdom of heaven is throwing its gates wide open, willing to accept any world-weary refugee that comes humbly accepting Jesus' manifest kingship. Jesus doesn't care about our nationalism. I mean, be a patriot. I'm certainly, you know, thankful and proud to be an American, but we cannot let it interfere with the true kingdom for which we belong, and we cannot let it fill us with a sense of entitlement or arrogance. We're not better than anyone else. Christianity is no small movement 2,000 years after Jesus, right? I mean, this is not a minority small movement in the corner of the Middle East. We have family in every country in the world. We are to care deeply for every country in the world. Those are our blood brothers. All those inspiring cliches we read about between Marines, how they have each other's backs no matter what, that should be us as Christians, except our bonds are thicker than O positive. It isn't boot camp that bonds us. It isn't a mutual love for America that bonds us. It isn't even a reverence for one another that bonds us, though each of these things are wonderful bonding agents and encouraged. It's our Father. It's Jesus that bonds us. Geography cannot get in the way of the gospel. Location cannot be a deterrent for us. Jonah was sent to Nineveh. And it's actually quite an understatement for me to say that that would be like you or I being sent to Aleppo. Nineveh is full of bad dudes, right? And I mean, that's a scary place for Jonah to go, and he tried real hard not to. So then we have to ask, where is God sending us? Most of us aren't being sent overseas to a hostile place, but, I mean, maybe someone here is. But God is wanting to break geographic boundaries. And geography includes nearby neighborhoods, social barriers, cultural distinctions, relationship demarcations of any kind. Maybe he's sending us somewhere closer. Maybe it's our next-door neighbors or the person in the cubicle next to us. Maybe it's an estranged friend or a dance team in another part of town. And listen, I'm not urging you to leave here and immediately go knock on someone's door and start yelling at them about how Jesus died for their sins. Don't be extra weird. We're already Christians. But do act like Jesus, right? Do be Jesus to your neighbors, to your enemies, to your family members. Let's keep going. Jesus goes full rap battle assassin here, rhyming with a literally supernatural flow. When the unclean spirit has gone out of a person, it passes through waterless places seeking rest, but finds none. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds the house empty, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and brings with it seven other spirits more evil than itself. And they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that person is worse than the first. So also will it be with this evil generation. Imagine this as a rap battle, and remember that the Pharisees, just a few verses earlier, called Jesus a demon. I did drop the mic, you see that? Let's try that again. Everybody hears me, right? Yeah, so Jesus, just a few verses earlier, was called demon by the Pharisees. They said that he was healing people for Satan, and then surely giving themselves dap for such a strong diss, right? And then Jesus quickly dismantles their prodding. But here he comes back to it. This is another common freestyling technique. And Jesus spits some cryptic fire about an unclean spirit who returns to an empty house, inviting more spirits to come over, and then calms his cadence to deliver the punch at the end. He says, "So also will it be with this evil generation." It's another one of those "oh" moments. And it not only exposes the Pharisees for being the vacant, self-righteous fools they are, it also leaves them speechless. How does someone respond to something like this? Jesus literally just dropped the mic, right, and walked away. That's what he did. The rap battle is over at this point. I mean, it's done. The Pharisees have to give up here. There's another very brief account before the end of the chapter, and we'll get to that in a minute. And then Jesus starts the next chapter off calmly teaching in parables. But this was the end of the road for the Pharisees. They have no more tricks up their sleeve. They've been battered and beaten, and they cannot keep sparring with Jesus. So they have to retreat and regroup, because obviously they're not going to let a beatdown like this stand. They have to come back looking for blood, anything to hold on to their now shakier reputations. But what is Jesus teaching to his followers in his dismantling the Pharisees? In recording this, Matt surely wants to preserve the drama of the story, but he also wants us to learn. And the attack Jesus levies at the end of this 45-verse back and forth is really a kind of summary of all the attacks he's leveled against the Pharisees all along. This final blow teaches us that membership in God's family, when this works, has nothing to do with power structures. The Pharisees' holier-than-thou attitude was born from a sense of pride in their political and theological position. We're better than you, they would say. There it is. We're better than you because we keep the law. We're better than you because we sit in seats of power. God values us more than God values you because we have authority. And God gave us that authority, so we must be righteous. But Jesus already revealed a different code by which his kingdom conducts business. He opened a certain sermon with this list of social structures being inverted. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Not only is power absent from Jesus' list, but the kind of spiritual power for which the Pharisees lusted after is actually antithetical to Jesus' list. They certainly aren't poor in spirit, and they're pouring anxiety over those who are. They aren't hungering and thirsting for righteousness, and they're telling those who are to only do so when and where the law allows it. They aren't persecuted for righteousness' sake, and really it's them that are persecuting the righteous. God isn't impressed with their show, and God isn't impressed with our show. Sacrificing our home life in order to make a career advancement so that people will respect us may work on that social level. Probably will. But God's not impressed. Buying that $80,000 car might trick a few people into thinking we're really something special, but God's not impressed. Conforming to a social or political group because it's what we're supposed to do may alleviate peer pressure, but God is not impressed. Jesus envisions their hearts like an empty house, so spacious that a single spirit invites seven roommates to join in. If we're serious about following Jesus, if we're serious about the idea of faith, I think we are, then we have to show it by trusting in his value system. In a world where power, and especially religious power, is valued and cherished, do we have the wherewithal to decline its allure and remain poor in spirit, pure in heart? None of us here are socially esteemed in the exact way that the Pharisees were in Jesus' day. But we're all esteemed in some way, everyone here. At work, at home, somewhere, someone looks up to you as a figure of authority. Do we value that authority as a sense of pride and honor that we can't let go of? Or do we, do something else? I mean, do we lust for more, promotions, for more exaltations? If this decision I'm making, this is something we can ask ourselves, if this decision I'm making is more in line with the self-esteeming, power-hungry, Pharisaical thinking that Jesus has demolished here in chapter 12, or is this more attuned to the other esteeming, poor in spirit, Sermon on the Mount thinking that Jesus espouses in chapter 5? We need to take note of the patterns in Jesus' words. Jesus throws around grace and mercy and forgiveness and tolerance like Lil Wayne throws around money in a music video. There is one kind of person, though, that Jesus will not tolerate. Jesus despises the person in power who abuses that power to demean and dehumanize others for his own benefit. The Pharisees exploit others and call it God's work. May we resist those same temptations when they come up in our lives. Let's move on, though, to this last bit to finish off the chapter. While he was still speaking to the people, behold, his mother and his brother stood outside, asking to speak to him. But he replied to the man who told him, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Jesus has already taught us that God's family isn't determined by geographic boundaries or power structures. And here, he teaches us that membership in God's family has nothing to do with biological disposition. We all have a biological family, at least those of us who raised our hand. And just as we all live somewhere, and just as we all have some influence and power in some way, none of that matters when it comes to membership within God's family. This is good news for a lot of people because a lot of people are born into some pretty cruddy situations. Barring adoption, we're kind of stuck with the families we're born into. Barring surgery, we're kind of stuck with the way we look. Geography, power, biology could all be phrased existentially as where we are, what we do, and who we are. Where we are, what we do, and who we are. Hopefully, God is playing the lead role in answering those questions for us. But membership into his family is not dependent upon any answers that we can provide. I am a healthy, white, cisgendered, straight, male, American citizen with two wonderful parents, three great siblings. I'm not rich by American standards, but I'm not poor by any reasonable standards either. I'm not president or pope, but I do hold some positions of authority. And none of that gets me onto the family roster. So what does? Jesus littered the chapter with hints, but his final words could probably be understood in a way that should be underlined by translators, maybe. Membership into God's family is determined not by geography or religious standards or biology, but by doing God's will. And membership in God's family has everything to do with doing the will of God. Any of the Pharisees could have stopped what they were doing and said, "Yeah, Jesus, that's a good point." Or at least said, "You know what, I'm going to pray about this sincerely, what you're saying to me, Jesus." But they had their own agenda. They were concerned with their own will. Jesus isn't excluding Mary and James and Jude and the rest of his earthly family in these verses. Rather, he's inviting many others into his family to enrich the whole of the family. Only those too self-righteous to yield their own will are to be left out. And it's important to note that doing God's will is a verb. It's what we were created for, to partner with God in the advancement of his kingdom. That is God's family. Our story's Genesis is full of verbs. Just a sampling from the first two chapters of the Bible, God created the heavens and the earth and its occupants. God ordered the day and the night, the water and the land, the sun and the moon. God blessed Adam and Eve and their descendants. God rested when he finished his good work. God formed Adam. God breathed life into him. God planted a garden. God made Eve. And God had verbs for Adam too. Adam was to work and keep the garden. Adam ate of the garden. Adam named the animals. Adam slept. We must do the will of God. We don't stumble into it. That's not how a partnership works. Maybe how some of the high school kids that I usually teach coast through their group projects, but that's not a partnership. That's not how doing the will of God looks. And Matt's going to elaborate on this more specifically in chapter 25 when he says by way of parable that he's separating the sheep from the goats. He endorses some to inherit the kingdom and some he doesn't. What is the measuring stick he uses for such a thing? How does he measure faith? Well, in Matthew 25, a sneak peek, he says, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? And when did we see you with a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly, I say to you, as you did it to the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me." To be in God's family, we are to do God's will. To do God's will, we are to treat the least with the same exaltation that the Pharisees tried to hoard. And being in God's family is cool because then he gets to tell us a bunch of weird stories, which is where we're going to pick it up next week. But let's pray and then get out of here. God, thank you so much for the words that you give us, that you're a God who stands up to the pious, powerful elite, that you don't stand for the corruption that they do, God. Thank you that all of us lowly servants, are exalted in your backwards ordering of things, God. Thank you that we're not forgotten, that you love us and you care about us enough to come to earth and to speak these words to those that are holding us down, God. And so may we hear those words and be encouraged by them, but may we also be reminded and encouraged not to stumble into those things ourselves when we're in positions of power, God. May we be more like you than the Pharisees. May we be more like you, God. We love you and we thank you, and it's our deep desire to do all of this. So help us along the way, God. Give us the strength and the capacity to do this in wonderful ways and to advance your kingdom as we do it. In Jesus' name, amen. And we have a blessing, maybe. At this point, it's not up to me. There it is. You want to all say this, stand and say this together. May Christ be a light to illumine and guide you. May Christ be a shield to overshadow you. Christ be under you. Christ be over you. Christ beside you, on your left and on your right, both in this world and the one to come. Go in peace, you children of God.